Commence primary ignition.
I'm just not the hero type, clearly.
What a piece of junk.
Enterprise, this is the captain.
I got a bad feeling about this.
It's all part of the plan.
Engage.
Welcome back to Podcast 2 for 1. I'm your host, Donovan Thompson, with my co-host,
Daniel Wingfield.
And today we are joined by none other than...
Bruce Hutchinson, back again. Yes.
Dr. Bruce Hutchinson.
I usually don't use that myself, so if you want the doctor in here, you have to introduce me. So.
Yeah, there you go.
You're goddamn right. We're using doctor. It's been a while, right? I mean, what was the last film we did? Die Hard.
Die Hard shit. Yeah
right after Christmas.
Yeah, our Christmas episode. That was great. Yeah, that was a really fun one.
Yeah. Three or four months.
Yeah, I've listened to that episode too many times. So like
I liked that. That was a fun one. A really fun one. Go check it out. We review Die Hard. Okay. Or Wait for Christmas.
Yeah, for sure.
There you go. And if you I'm sorry, Bruce.
Go ahead. Do the plug.
I was going to say, if you haven't, of course, go to our YouTube channel and subscribe, youtube.com/2for1studios. Hit us up on our Instagram. Every like and subscribe helps us out, and we really appreciate it. Go on, Bruce. What are you saying?
Yeah, I'm just sad that I haven't been back sooner. We were trying to do like once a month, but life just kind of interfered there in the spring.
Life, the world seems to be returning to some normalcy.
Yeah.
In the near future, at least. So maybe we can be a little more consistent going forward.
I am vaccinated. So
I'm halfway through. I get my second one in like 2 weeks.
So next time we do this, I'm totally fine going back to the studio.
There you go.
Yeah.
As
soon as Donovan has recovered as well. I know he hurt his back a while back. So we've been doing this way as well to take care of him.
Yep. Anyway, guys, we were talking The Bourne Identity. I know it's been shuffled around a couple times what movie we're going to talk about, and then we kind of landed on that one.
We've got a list though. We had quite a few of a list.
We do have a list. And this movie is 18 years old now. It's a full adult years old, basically.
Right. It can vote, but it can't. No, it can go to war too.
Can't buy alcohol.
Buy alcohol.
Yeah, I guess it can drink. It just can't buy alcohol.
There you go. And it's directed by Doug Liman and written by Tony Gilroy and William Blake Herron. My dad was a huge fan of these movies, and you know, I was quite young when they come out, and I enjoyed them, but I think at the time they were a little complicated for me as a young kid. You know, I was probably 9 or 10 when they were coming out, and they felt complicated at the time. I don't think so much anymore, but I know we've talked about a few of the different movies in class over the years, and I want us to break down the whole movie, but real quick, general impressions. How do you guys feel about the movie 18 years later?
Go ahead, Bruce.
I still like it a lot. It was definitely a movie that I watched a lot as just, you know, kind of those pleasure action movies that I would return to over and over again. I think it holds up pretty well. I'm a big spy movie fan. Of course, we talked about Atomic Blonde year, I guess. Maybe it was the year before. I don't even know anymore.
It was 2020.
Okay, good.
It was.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's a little unfortunate, you know, maybe we will talk about some of the later movies. I thought it, you know, in terms of being like a possible franchise to compete with Bond, Bourne seemed like it could be that movie. And the first one is great. And I like the next two as well, but it never really seemed to take off in terms of kind of becoming that. You know, of course, Bond, you know, those budgets are huge and everything. And this was going to always be a slightly smaller scale, but just like smart, fun action movies. I still enjoy the first one a lot. I think it holds up pretty well.
Cool. Daniel?
Yeah, I agree. I think I really enjoy the stakes in this movie and how small they are, how personal they are. It's basically just Jason wanting to... figure out what's going on, who he was, and then honestly get away from that. And then the antagonist is just trying to save his own ass because he made mistakes. And I like that. I like that kind of action film. I like that kind of espionage film. I enjoy the action. I like Matt Damon. And I think he does a good, like, it's so weird. It's like, I don't remember watching this and thinking, oh, he's young, or like, I feel like I already knew Matt Damon at that point, but I'm like, man, he's so young in this film. He's so scrawny. But I think he does a great job. Like I said, I like the action. I forgot Clive Owen was in it. And like, you know, there's just these little things that I think are it flows well. I feel like the cause and effect gets kicked off and just kind of takes you to the end really well. I really enjoy it still.
Yeah. My dad really liked these movies a lot, and it was always something he looked forward to. And honestly, this might surprise you guys. I was never a huge fan of the Bourne movies. And I still enjoyed pieces of them and stuff. And I've rewatched them multiple times over the years. And I watched the whole franchise over the last week to kind of prep for this. And my opinion is still kind of the same. Like, I still enjoy pieces of it. And I can look at it and see how people like it and stuff. But it's not something that I'm ever like, man, I just love the Bourne franchise. Like, I just love what they're doing with it. And, but looking at the first movie by itself, I think it's a solid movie. I think it's, you know, I like Matt Damon in it. I'm glad that I like him in other things, and it's cool to see him in a role like that. And I like, they have some really good supporting characters. Like you said, Clive Owen, and I can't think of the actor's name, but the guy who is basically the head honcho guy who.
His main antagonist.
Yeah, the
guy
not
above.
Not the Treadstone guy, but the guy above him.
Can't think of his name. The main guy in two.
Yes, I love that actor, and I love the Treadstone actor guy too, and they're both great. And you know, I do enjoy it. It's just not something that I can just constantly go back to, like a John Wick or The Matrix or some that kind of action movie. Oh, those are both Keanu movies. That's weird. And some of my other thoughts I have on it, I can save to the end, because I think it kind of encompasses some of the just problems I have with this movie, and also with almost every movie, actually, with the whole franchise. Anyway, let's kind of start talking about the movie and kind of breaking it down. I don't think this one's as complicated as some of the other ones, because it's so action focused. And so it's kind of easier to talk about in a lot of ways. And it's kind of straightforward, you know, it's really interesting.
It does have one kind of twist to it, which we'll get to in terms of kind of the middle of the movie. It has a unique middle act structure, which we'll get to when we get to that. And it's kind of something that I think proves the rule for the approach that I take, and you know, that we've discussed on the podcast, in terms of whether we have sequences or acts, that we have sort of these equal section. You know, we have, let's say, 10 to 15 yeah. minute long sequences or 30 minute long acts. There's something a little unique going on with Bourne that I'll talk about when we get to act two.
That's awesome. And if this is one of those scripts that if people listening to it or watching the video, you can download the script. I will say that the version that I found and the one that I shared with them is, it's a little different. And that happens, of course, you know, during pre-production or even before shooting. So,
well, I actually... I was doing some research, just this is relevant. Apparently the ending changed many times during production.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was in flux the whole time. So that makes sense, total sense why, you know, the ending here isn't up to date. Because I mean they were probably writing it the night before, some of it.
Oh, I'm kind sure. Of stuff, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And especially with action movies, you know, like they can, you know, you get in there and the space is different than the writer had, or X, Y, and Z. You can't blow up a car on this certain day or whatever. And so it changes things, you know, of course, you know. Also, did you guys, not to put you guys on the spot, you guys said you didn't read the script, or you did read the script?
I did not read the script.
Okay.
I got through most of it, yeah.
I'll say this before we get into it. One thing that kind of bugged me, or not bugged me, but like, man, I don't want to do that when I write. They're very, very detailed with the action. And it's like the sequences are so long with the action that I got tired of reading the action. And, you know, yes. I'm an action guy.
Yeah.
Because it felt all, and there was things that was, you know, story focused that helped you like know about Bourne's character. But I was like, man, if you write an action sequence, either A, in my head, like you need to write insert action sequence as a writer, or B, you need to at least do description. But the action scene needs to be like 2-3 minutes and not 6-7 pages or something. So
well, and that I think there's something interesting there, because I agree, and maybe we say this as the maybe part of the end discussion. I don't know, but they're very. Like, he describes the action movement for movement, almost like in perfect detail. Like he's telling you exactly what happens, exactly where Bourne goes, does this, does that, which is in some ways opposite to what the action is in the film, where it's these quick cuts, shaky camera. Like, you know, he's punching, but where exactly did he hit him? Somewhere in there. Or like, for example, with the guards in the Zurich park, when he first, we really got our first action scene. You can follow it. It's not Bourne Ultimatum yet. Right.
Right.
But it's still not, like, it doesn't feel necessarily like what, for one, it's definitely not. There's some distinct differences between the action scenes and the script in terms of how bloody they are and violent they are. It's much more that way in the script than it is in the film. But yeah, I do feel like it's an interesting parallel that these action scenes are so described in detail. Yeah. Almost, yeah, like you said, too much, like to the point where I'm like, I don't necessarily need all this to get the idea that he beat these guys up, right?
Yeah, I will kind of add a little antidote, is that the way the writers tackle it in the script is that they're basically trying to tell you, they're trying to tell the reader Jason's headspace or Jason's skill set through the action. That it comes across much differently on camera because it's so quick and you're realizing that, oh, he's like a trained expert, versus in the script, it's much more slowed down and trying to tell you something about his character. So maybe that's more for the directors and those kind of people. So maybe I'm being a little too harsh on it, but, and there's things I really want to talk about at the end here. But let's get into the opening of the movie. So we know that it starts off on a boat, and Jason Bourne is floating upon sea and he's saved, and it kind of kicks off our movie, right? He has amnesia and he's got two bullet holes in the back. And the question of all movie characters of all time, who am I? So, and we start our journey.
Yeah. It's a pretty slow opening. It takes us a while to even get him awake. Or really the action to even start really kicking off. Really once they get to the shore. That was something I noticed on my rewatch. It's just like that. I don't recall this being quite as gradual, I guess.
Yeah. Bruce, what do you think about this first?
You know, it does take a little bit of time, but you know, I think one of the things about the Bourne franchise is it has this reputation that Daniel's sort of referring to, especially with the second two and Paul Greengrass directing, where it's like crazy action and, you know, this crazy camera and all this stuff. But the movies are still more, I mean, I don't want to say cerebral because they're still action movies, but you know, they like you were saying, Donovan, I think that they are playing at being a little smarter than the average action movie. And so actually there's a lot of places where the movies, where all of them and this one too are a little slower, you know, where they take time to set up plot, to set up intrigue, you know. It's not like we get a whole bunch of character development necessarily, but they're a little more willing to kind of take their time to set things up. And I think that's what's going on here. You know, this question of who Bourne is, you know, it doesn't just drive the first movie. It drives all of the movies basically.
which is my problem with them all. So
sorry, go ahead.
So when you get to the franchise, but you know, for this one, because of that, I think it takes its time sort of setting up that question and really sort of making it clear, you know, that this is going to be an important aspect of this movie.
And let me just say, that was not a critical thing. I think that's the reason I enjoy this series more than maybe some action films, is because I feel like we get these small moments to connect to the characters. And so I feel like I really connect with Bourne and Marie in this one, which I think makes two even more impactful, how that one starts off. And I think that's part of the reason I really like the series is those slow moments, is the willingness to slow down and not rush into the next action sequence.
Yeah.
Let's just kind of, I think it might be easier, since it's kind of a simple movie, instead of going through beat for beat what happens, we can do that. But let's talk about either Bruce, either you have it in sequences or acts, the first act or whatever, and kind of hit the end point. And we can talk about what happens through that act and as we go through there.
Yeah, so I've got a real typical 30-minute first act, basically 29 minutes, you know, and climaxes with Bourne escaping the embassy. That's sort of our big, you know, action set piece that kind of is the climax of the act. It doesn't quite end there. You know, I think Bourne getting a ride from Marie, and then Conklin activating all of the agents, right? Because that's what's going to drive kind of, especially act two, is that there's going to be multiple people coming after him. And because of the power of the CIA, you know, the police, wherever they go, you know, seem to automatically know that they're on the run and are immediately after them, right? So, so I think that escape, getting the ride with Marie, Conklin sending all the agents, that kind of wraps up act one. And then act two is going to start, you know, as Bourne and Marie are heading to Paris. So.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
so
I like, sorry, go ahead.
Go for it. No, go for it.
I like this act. I feel like it's very tight in terms of we begin with him finding the, which I think the script says he pulls that little laser thing out of his ass. I didn't realize it was his ass. I don't think when I was watching it. Maybe
in the movie, it's his hip.
Okay, that's what I thought. I was like, was it in his butt?
Although it's weird because when they do the surgery, it looks like it's coming out of his back. And then you're like, how could he ever get this thing out of his own back?
I thought it was his back.
But then they reference the hip. Then the doctor says, you know, why did you have this thing in your hip? So presumably he could dig it out of his own hip if he needed to. Go. But
but that immediately kicks off going to the bank. And the bank is our big climax. And then we escape the bank. Or sorry, not the bank. Well, it is the bank into the embassy, I guess. But at the same time, I like that we're popping over to get this American like intel side of things where they're starting to realize something's gone wrong, and they kind of build the dread up so that when they release the agents, it's kind of feels like you've been really, I guess the tension is built up to that. And it's a really fun, like kind of, and I love the, and I guess this is more act two, but I love the montage of the activating agents. I love it. I love the guy in the meeting looking at the phone. Like, I just love all that shit. That's like my kind of spy movie shit. These sleeper agents in like different countries, just under a different personas. I love it.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting to me is for myself is that I do like the action bits, of course, in the first act here, but I think the things that are most interesting to me again are the Treadstone director and then the his superior, like the way they talk to each other, which you kind of get into the CIA spy stuff there of, you know, I thought you would never ask me that question. Like, I like that kind of stuff. Like, to me, that it really builds up this intrigue of who this character is, but it kind of starts almost, for me, this is kind of where I start kind of having the problem with the franchise, honestly, is like, I feel like we're always so ahead of Bourne. Like, I feel like because of all, they don't know what they're doing. We automatically know, of course, who he is. Like, and granted, part of that is it's been 18 years since I've seen the movie. I know, obviously, he's a whoever he is. But I feel like I think I would have been better if we had even less of that, maybe, and kind of built up. He doesn't, you know, it's hard to do that when you're kicking ass and you have transmitter in your hip or your ass, whatever it is. I get that, but I think there's something there for me the whole time is like he's always reacting, you know, and I don't know,
I mean, we kind of, except for a couple of like the action sequences that we're like, we are in Bourne's perspective of, oh, he thinks he hears something and then someone attacks or whatnot. Yeah. We kind of know, I mean, and even then we know the assassins are coming, right? Like we kind of have a God perspective, I guess, like the narrator is telling us everything and not really keeping a lot hidden at all. Other than just how will it work out? I mean, that's kind of the tension of the suspense of is what will be the resolution. But yeah, I agree with you. I think I could see it working a little better if maybe they saved some of that for reveals a little bit into the movie.
Yeah.
But I think we have to be careful with sort of discussing this movie versus discussing the franchise, because
I agree.
I think you're right about that, but I don't think it's a problem for this particular movie. I think where it becomes a problem is by the third movie, you're still in that same mode and he's still seeking answers, but the answers seem less and less
interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, okay, you know, the big thing is he figures out that he's a spy, you know, but now he figures out that this project was, you know, experimenting on soldiers or something, you know, in later stuff. So it's just like,
he figures out, you know, his name.
The biggest thing, yeah, the biggest thing he figures out is in this movie. And then it's almost like the stakes get smaller as we go on. And as Daniel mentioned, you know, we sort of have Marie as an important character here, I think, to give more depth to the movie. Later on, you know, he has Julia Stiles' character kind of as an ally, but overall he seems more on his own and sort of less people involved with him. So the stakes don't seem as high and the questions seem smaller. So, but you know, but again, that's two separate things, right?
Sure. Sure. I agree with that. I agree with that. I think, yeah, I just haven't pegged it yet. And I was feeling this way in this movie and maybe again, that's what I was saying. Maybe it's because I have the foresight of what's coming ahead. But there's something there. I haven't quite pegged it yet.
Will say there is one thing that I don't like about this movie. And it's funny that you mentioned the scenes with Abbott and Conklin, who are Brian Cox and Chris Cooper, by the way, are two fantastic actors. So the cast is great all the way through. But I honestly, I've always felt like the stuff with the CIA sort of in Conklin's little area always felt very low budget.
It does.
Like, yeah.
You know, it felt like they ran out of money and then had to shoot all of this stuff. And so, you know, they've got this room kind of with some computers in it. And,
you know,
you can see how hard Doug Liman is trying to make those scenes feel energetic. I mean, you know, like later on when they're like trying to track down people he's, you know, had contact with, you get like all these whip pans and all this stuff. Two computer screens and guys walking through a room. And it's like, you know, he's trying to make these scenes super interesting and they're really just not that interesting. And
they're like printing out wanted posters. Yeah.
Yeah. And the production design of the office isn't especially exciting.
No, I agree.
Which is a shame because like Daniel, when they activate all the sleeper agents and we get all the on-screen graphics, I love that stuff. And I don't want to claim that this is like the first movie to ever do it, but I do feel like it was one of the first movies to sort of popularize this, like really using these graphical things on the screen to, you know, like, you know, we're like overhead maps that'll zoom in and then, you know, the
enhance.
Oh my God. Yes.
Enhance.
He said enhance.
Kind
of
stuff, you know,
it was just like enhance. I was like, is this what began the trope? I wonder, because he just said enhance and it just zooms in and it's a better picture now.
Yeah. I think it was Star Trek or TNG enhance.
It probably was. Star Trek did that too.
So.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
But yeah, in terms of just the on-screen graphics, you know, where we're at and sort of really using those to be able to move around fast and make it feel very cool. You know, it just, that does add to the excitement. So it's kind of disappointing then to have this, you know, kind of low budget. It's probably pretty realistic actually, you know, I mean, at least for the time, you know, a CIA office where they're running spies probably was just a really boring room with some computers in it. But we expect a little bit more.
I agree. You know, and one thing that kind of struck me is like, I kind of forgot, this movie doesn't feel like it, you know, it feels like a classical Hollywood film in terms of like it's, you know, it's plots and characters and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's that stuff, but like the filmmaking behind it feels like a French film to me. You know, it feels like, you know, just the, everything. I mean,
feels like an indie film.
It does. It does. It's like a high budget indie film. Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does.
Well, and it was, you know, Doug Liman's first movie, I think, after Go, which was what put him on the map, was a super indie movie. And then, of course, you know, the trend in Hollywood, he went from this indie movie to this bigger blockbuster type movie. Brought an indie sensibility, but kind of like with the ending, I think there was a lot of reports as to whether he was sort of overwhelmed with things or not or whatever. And I'm not saying he was, and he's, you know, sure, he's a fine director, but there was a lot of like, you know, there's a lot to handle, you know.
Yeah. I'm sorry for that little tangent, guys. Let's kind of get back to the act here. So as you said, Daniel, he makes his way to the bank, Bourne does, and he finds his deposit box, of course, and it has all his identities. And the first one he sees is Jason Bourne, which kind of is one that, you know, he sticks with for the franchise and happens to be also in Paris, where his name is on the hotel or whatever later his apartment. So it works out that he finds that name ID first.
Well, the one that's on top, and then the other ones are in the hidden compartment.
You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
And, of course, they recognize him, and he's trying to figure all this stuff out. You guys remind me, it's been a week since I watched these movies. Actually, fun fact, it took me 3 tries to finish The Bourne Identity. Like, it's yeah, it did. I watched it, and I was like, I had to keep stopping. I was like, man, so I don't know what it is about this. But
I think we're just figuring out that you're not a spy movie fan.
Yeah,
no, I think you hate spy movies.
You say Bond you too, are, right? But
you don't like Bond.
You were not a fan of Atomic Blonde either, so I, you know,
maybe
you need to look hard and long into your soul, there, Donovan, and see if you really are a spy movie fan.
Yeah, I know. Hey, I've seen Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and that's a dry spy movie.
Yeah, I haven't.
That's seen that. Yeah. It's
I enjoy that one too, but
yeah, it's you know. Anyway, so after Daniel enlightened me, after the bank and the deposit box, what happens from there? I don't remember.
I think that's when he is noticing that people are police. I guess, oh no, that's what happens. The guy in the bank calls into the U.S. and is like, Bourne was here. Then the police start chasing him, which makes him run into the embassy. And then the embassy eventually starts chasing him. And then.
Right. Oh, well, okay. Well, yeah. I guess we missed the part where he's on the bench. I think it's really important.
Oh, that's before the bank.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's important because that's like your first tell there that he's obviously, you know, we've already seen Treadstone or at least the people behind Treadstone. But that's like the ultimate tell there is that he's a spy and he's takes the guards out really quickly. And he's also even a character moment is that I think he puts the gun away because he's like scared of the gun and
no, he like disassembles it.
Right. Disassembles it, but he doesn't take it with him, which is important.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think on a character.
Yeah. In the script, he like puts the gun to the guard's head and the guard like begs for his life. It's much more visceral and makes him much less likable, I think, if they had done that.
Yeah. The script's a little darker in the movie in general. Yeah, but anyway, I thought that was just important. It's a little character thing. You know, it's your first time seeing it. Yeah, bank, deposit box, embassy. Okay.
And I will say the, like, automatic, like, reaction thing to the guards, like, putting his hand on his – or sticking him with the nightstick, whatever, I've always loved that. I've always been like, that's so badass that he just does it without trying to. And, like, it's just, like, programmed into him that deeply. I've always thought that was just – cool.
Yeah, it's
cool.
Well, and it's shot pretty well. I mean, it's pretty simple, but you know, the guy sort of pulls out his baton and you see Bourne's hand, and there's like this close up of Bourne putting his hand on the baton, and it's this great foreshadowing moment. I mean, it's foreshadowing something's gonna happen 5 seconds later, but you know, you're like, oh, okay, there is something here, you know, with just that shot.
Well, and he even has a look that's kind of matches the audience of like, right, oh, wait, right. What? What's this? You know, kind of like, I love the look on his face of like, I just did that and I'm about to do more kind of thing. Yeah. And it's,
But so No, go ahead. Honestly, you know, we've basically described the act until we get to the end. There's not a lot of action here. You know, you basically got the boat, and then once he gets off the boat, you've got the bank and the embassy, and then you've got sort of the climax where he meets Marie. In terms of action, and you compare it to other action movies like a Bond movie or Atomic Blonde that we've talked about or John Wick, there's a lot less action. And really, other than the beating up of the police officers in the park, the only action is the set piece at the embassy.
And he's mainly running and then hanging. I mean, we have a pretty long scene of him hanging off the fire. I mean, again, the indie feeling of it, like we take that long just on a fire escape in a pretty simple location, there's a lot of tension there, and it's a pretty simple moment. For a lot of action films, it would have been much more dramatic and probably, you know, ridiculous what the tension point was.
it's built a lot more around suspense, you know, sort of what is he going to do? How is he going to deal with this? And I've always enjoyed the embassy scene, and it reminds me a lot of Spy Games, which is another one of my favorite, Robert Redford,
Owen Wilson,
Brad Pitt, directed by Tony Scott. Who did you say?
I said Owen Wilson. I meant Brad Pitt, though. I'm sorry. Brad Pitt. I was thinking that. I mixed up I Spy for a second.
And Spy Games is another spy movie that's really concerned with spycraft, you know? And so I think that, and probably does it a lot better than this movie, because this movie's more an action movie, but I do like the spycraft elements of it. So I like the way he handles the embassy, you know, the way he pulls the, comes off very easily, but the map off the wall, the way he grabs the radio, right?
Yes.
And it's all about being smart and getting out of the situation more than it is about running around shooting a bunch of people. And I enjoy that in spy movies. I mean, you have to have a balance. Of course, you also want, you know, the fights and that kind of stuff. But I really enjoy sort of the smartness of that scene and the way in which he gets out of the embassy.
I was going to say, I think that's where I get the most enjoyment of the franchise, is seeing how they take everyday situations and objects and that kind of stuff, and had some, what people in a real situation in a fight would do, use everything you possibly can to win.
Yes.
And that's the thing I enjoy about the most. And exactly, when he grabs the map and he's looking at it and listening in, to me, that's like the coolest part of the embassy, is that one moment there. And they're all running the opposite direction he is, you know, and he's walking, you know, he's so smart about it.
And I really actually appreciate the restrained whole, the way they do the action. I appreciate that we don't just get agent, you know, spy versus spy fights, or him taking down a bunch of guards constantly. I like, because again, getting into the second act now, the first spy versus spy fight in his Paris apartment is amazing. I love it. And I feel like what works so well about it is like, the tension of, we know the spies, like all the agents have been called up. We've seen what he can do in the part. We know he's a good fighter. He's been running. He's on the run. And it's just kind of this almost like a release of finally getting to see him at his most violent, or his most, martial art expertist, whatever. I like that we're just not kind of bombarded with that. And I feel like, because when we get them, they feel more significant and they feel more special and meaningful.
Well, the stakes are being raised, and it's a good use of raising constantly the stakes of it all, and what's, you know, his livelihood and everything else. Before we get into that part of the assassins being called for, I do want to talk about Marie. We get a hint of her at the embassy where she's being denied, entry. And then we get, of course, when he lands right next to her vehicle, or he lit close to her vehicle outside, and then he ends up giving you, obviously you understand quickly that she's someone who's, you know, a normal person. I say desperate for money, but $10,000 or $20,000 is good no matter who you are, I think.
Yeah.
And, even though, you know, I like that he's looking at the sirens and she picks up on that and what have you done? But then he's like, well, I'll just take it anywhere else. And you still get I'll still drive you. And I think it's a good way to put them together. And that little scene with her in the embassy is just enough to kind of set up her financial situation, and just that she's having, she's a person having bad luck lately. So.
Yeah. Overall, I'm a fan of that character and the way it interacts with the movie. I like Franca Potente, who had been in Run Lola Run a few years before. So I like the fact that they cast a European actress for that, because we do have a lot of American actors, but the movie is taking place in Europe. I like having her in there, and I think she's well handled. She's a smart, intelligent character, but also she makes what you might call dumb choices, but you understand them, right? I mean, first of all, there's an attraction, but second of all, as you learn more about her, and as like the Treadstone guys are like talking about how she's never been in one place for more than a few months. And then we find out that, I mean, we don't really know if he was married, but we assume she had an affair with a married man at some point. Like, you also get this sense that she's kind of an adventurer. She's a bit of a thrill seeker, you know? So there are moments where she could have bowed out of this whole thing safely, and yet she doesn't. And I never question it, right? It just seems to fit. And of course, her hair color and the costume design all fit into that as well. And so she is smart and intelligent, but she also, you know, there's just a thrill to this thing that she seems like she doesn't want to leave behind, you know, and she kind of wants to know how all this is going to play out, even if it's super dangerous, you know. So, yeah, I think she's a great character.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Daniel. There's a little extra thing there of they're like, who is this person? And like, is she actually somebody that, you know, he's in contact with? And that's right. Just, I think, a great little extra nugget there. So,
yeah.
I was going to say, I really like what they do in their first kind of car ride that I think really solidifies who she is. Like the whole, like you're the only person I know and don't stop talking. It's relaxing. Like she feels needed. And that makes so much sense when you get all that. Again, it's kind of building a very realistic, flawed character that you like, and is still someone you want to succeed. And, you know, but I really like it. Just, you kind of have this, like, they're codependent on each other, but for different reasons. He like literally doesn't know, you know, like has no resources or anywhere to go or whatever. And then she just, you know, is, like you said, the thrill seeker, but also she's needed in a way that's like, probably makes her feel good or whatever. Yeah. I really like Marie as well. I think she's a very realistic character.
Yeah.
And she's another part of what makes this world feel so real, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is one thing I want to say. I know you didn't read it, Bruce, but in the driving sequence in the script, the line about, you know, you made me feel comfortable or whatever it is, or I like listening to you talk, is not in there. And he's actually, he's much more cold. And that, I think, adding that in back into the movie, plus Matt Damon's, like, his sweetness, his earnestness, and kind of like when he's not in Bourne mode.
He has an innocence
to him.
Yeah.
And it goes a long way in shaping that character for me in a good way.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So he activates the agents, Conklin does, and we kind of know trouble is on the way, right? And they're trekking across X, Y, and Z, but they're trying to
get to Paris
to get to his apartment, right? That's kind of where we're going to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because he has an address. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And again, another great scene on the way that isn't, you know, that's in the process is the diner scene. And like we said, like the talking about the badass stuff with Bourne, when he's like, when he rattles off that list of information, I know every driver's light plate out in the parking lot. I can tell you that guy over there can handle himself in a fight. I can tell you the red pickup is the best place to find a gun. Like that kind of stuff is like really cool. and again, it just kind of compounds the coolness and the mystique of his character.
Yeah. Whenever someone, if the idea or the conversation of Bourne comes up ever, that's that line he delivers about knowing who to take out, that's the first thing I always think of when I think of the Bourne Identity, is that diner sequence. And that's like, it's one of my favorite scenes in the whole franchise, actually.
Yeah. And that's another sort of spycraft scene. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Yes. Yeah. It's really, really cool. Yeah. I told Daniel, you know, that this movie is going to be like probably the easiest one we talk about because it's pretty straightforward in terms of what happens and just, you know, cause and effect and X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, the next big scene is getting to the apartment, and obviously the climax of that is the fight. But I think there's some good, again, that kind of slow building of the world and taking their time to get to the fight. That I like the housekeeper moment, them, you know, having to go along with it, and then, you know, looking through, just trying to find any clue of who he is or what he did or what he does. I really enjoyed that whole kind of I guess it's a big sequence. I really liked it.
Yeah. So just to back up for a second, because Act Two does have this sort of slightly unique structure that I was referring to earlier, and Daniel's actually kind of touching on sort of where that transition happens. Well, not exactly, but so this feels, I don't want to say old fashioned, but Act Two is actually a normal, I want to say normal, but this movie has a three-act structure in the sort of old Sid Field three-act structure kind of approach, which is the middle act is actually a 60-minute middle act with kind of a midpoint, but no change in goal. And so we basically have goals that are driving a 60-minute act, which is actually kind of unusual, but it's actually also kind of interesting because I think there's two goals going on for this movie for Bourne, right? Especially in the middle section. One is to figure out who he is, and the other one is to evade capture, right? Is to evade the agents that have been sent after him. So he has these two goals, and sort of the trick is how do you structure that, right? How do you take these two goals and kind of move between them or deal with them? And if you were going to do kind of our normal approach, the way we talk about it, where we would have four acts and you would have two middle acts, you'd have like a second act where he's trying to discover who he is. And then you'd have a third act where he's trying to evade capture, right? Problem with that is I don't think you could sustain a 30-minute act where he's trying to figure out who he is. Right. Yeah. You just have 30 minutes of him investigating. And then after that, you'd have 30 minutes of him running and fighting. Right. It wouldn't really make any sense. So it's kind of interesting. We still have two goals as if they were an act two and an act three and a four act structure. But really, it's just that they've taken the two goals and wedded them together, right? And then made one long act two where we bounce back and forth between those two goals. And if you look at the start of act two, you know, the first half a dozen scenes are all, you know, driving to Paris, arriving in Paris, or driving to Paris, you know, the diner, arriving in Paris, finding the apartment, looking around the apartment, calling the hotel, right? So the first 10 to 15 minutes of that act are all trying to figure out who he is. And then, you know, he gets attacked by the first guy. And then the rest of that act is him trying to evade capture, right? And then we're actually going to see the repetition. We're going to kind of have a midpoint. And then we're going to have kind of the first half of the act be about him trying to figure out who he is. And then the second half of the act are, you know, trying to evade capture. So it just kind of bounces back and forth. It almost becomes a little bit of a sequence structure. It's just that they repeat, you know. So you've got this 60 minutes of act two, and it's just figure out who he is, evade capture, figure out who he is, evade capture, right? And then at the end of that, we launch into the final act. So it is an interesting kind of approach to, you can't actually have a 60-minute long act, but in this case, there's two goals that we're just intercutting between them.
One thing that's also an extra layer that does change for this is that Marie's goal changes. Is that hers is to get to Paris to get the money. She ends up liking him. You know, she goes upstairs, and then it becomes, you know, that great moment. I think my favorite moments of her is she approaches the assassin, which we'll get to the fight in a second. She approaches the assassin as like, why do you have my picture? And then it becomes like, you know, of course, after the fight, you can stay here or you don't. I don't know what the best idea is. And then she, of course, goes with him. But I think that's where she does have a kind of a change in a goal. Obviously, it's to, I guess, survive or to see it through or to, you know, I guess use what you could say, you know. So,
yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, obviously they use the action in a smart way so that it doesn't feel as repetitive between, you know, between the first half of the act and the second half of the act, because the assassin attacking them makes them get away. And then we get, you know, a really fun car chase sequence that is, again, it's giving us really fun action and building. And I mean, the fight alone, I mean, the when he pulls out the pin, I'm like, okay, this is awesome. Like the pin thing is awesome. I mean, and he's just toying with him. And it's like, it's just great. Like it just make you just smile and you're like, fuck yeah. And then the car chase scene, I love, again, we kind of have another moment where he's like, you should leave right now. You should get out right now. Like so there's almost like another moment where Marie chooses again to stay with him. And then you get that great car. And again, they're like approaching and you're like, why would he even wait this long? Like they're going to trap him. And then he's like, but he's not worried. And of course, because he knows a way out, because, you know, he's a super spy. And I just think that kind of stuff is so fun and interesting that it doesn't feel like, oh, well, why are we asking the same questions again? Why is this happening again? Because that is enough to make sense. I guess it justifies them having to stop their search and put that on pause for a bit and then come back to it. But also it's just fun stuff. And so it's good action so that when we pause and get slow and ask questions again, it feels like a nice break and a nice rhythm, I guess.
Yeah. One thing I will say is about the car chase thing is I remember when the movie came out back in the day, 2002, and I remember people talking about the car chase then, about how cool and how good it was. And, you know, I will say that even watching all the movies and this one particularly is that it's something I do miss. I miss old school way of car chases. And also something about this one too is it reminds me of like a movie like Ronin, like that kind of car chase, you know, and it feels real. It feels on the ground. It feels visceral, and just the way they do the camera movements and everything else. And that's something I miss. And don't get me wrong, I'm there that night for Fast 9, you know, but there's a difference when you have real things smashing into each other. Yes. And yep. It feels, you know, way different, and you got to commend them for that. Yeah. Also, they didn't have CGI back then, so they couldn't if they wanted to. You know, they did, but they didn't have the budget for
it. Way too expensive. So. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But there is something different about it. I need to do more research on that part of it, but I can't pinpoint it yet on the filmmaking level. But there's something about it that stands it apart from the other stuff. But yeah.
Well, it's kind of a claustrophobic one, right? Because it's these tiny Parisian streets and alleys and going down, you know, stairs in this tiny ass little European car. So I feel like it just feels more subtle. I mean, I feel like, again, when I think of the classic car chase, they're in like, you know, muscle cars, or, you know what I mean? And this is just this tiny, unassuming, most people would like laugh at this car. And then Jason Bourne's doing these incredible things with it. And it just makes him seem even that much cooler and badass, I think.
Well, I think I'm sorry, Bruce. One little nugget is that I think it's like, this is an American action movie, but it's that scene is we're in, maybe it's not an American action movie, but that scene's European, right? And we're in Paris. So it's, you know, the aesthetic alone kind of separates it from all these other action films in the 90s, like Speed and all these other stuff. You know, it has a different location. You have different, you know, architecture. So it makes you move certain ways. And anyway, I think it adds to it.
Well, yeah. And the streets of Paris, I mean, you know, the cars probably never go faster than 40 miles per hour, you know? And I think that's a big part of what you guys are talking about, is that the chase is about what the chase realistically is about, which is him trying to get away from the cops, you know? And of course it's thrilling, but it's not specifically like sacrificing that to make the cars go really fast. And, you know, and the stunts feel completely integrated. And again, like Donovan, I love Fast and Furious, but the stunts aren't always integrated into the chase. But when Bourne has to drive down a flight of stairs, you buy it and believe it because you understand Paris as a certain kind of city, and that the streets are going to be narrow and that there aren't these big highways and all this kind of stuff. And that's something he's going to have to do to try to get away from the police, you know, and he's got the skills to do it. Right. So yeah, I agree. And, you know, this first 30 minutes of Act Two, honestly, I think is working really well. Again, I mean, the fight that we mentioned, this car chase, I think everything is working at its best in this Bourne movie in, you know, I guess the second 30 minutes of the movie. I'll also note that kind of near the end of this is when we get the introduction of Wambosi and the beginnings of the plot line with him, you know, where I think sort of after the car chase, we cut to Wambosi visiting the morgue and we begin to build up, okay, you know, we know Bourne's a spy, but we really haven't, you know, we haven't been introduced to any idea yet. And in terms of, you know, Conklin and Treadstone and why Bourne doesn't know who he is and what happened, right? We don't know any of that. And so this is where kind of halfway at the midpoint that the movie begins to open up that subplot, you know, to develop the second half of the movie.
And I'll say for me personally, this might be my weakest part of the film, is Not and actually, I'll say this. I really like the beginning stuff with Mombosi. I like the actor that's playing him, and I think he portrays a really realistic character. I like his kind of tenacity and like fire. I mean, obviously he dies right after he's talking about like, you know, I'll kill them myself or whatever. But the reveal at the end that's connected with this, and we can get later on with it. I didn't love it. And I know to me, it kind of breaks some of the realism that I've been accepting so far. And we can get to that, but I think this may be like this subplot or where this, you know, this part of the subplot where it ends and how it explains, you know, Bourne's amnesia, I think is maybe my weakest part.
I do want to note that the actor who plays Mombosi is also Mr. Echo from Lost.
Oh, I know. Oh, yeah, I know. He's great. Mr. Echo. Oh yeah, that's a big reason why I like him, and he's fucking awesome in Lost too. He's one of my favorite characters in Lost.
I saw Christy post recently, and she just maybe both of you just finished Lost again. So yeah.
Yeah, we did rewatch Lost. Just finished.
Good
it.
Show.
Yeah.
I love Lost. I think it's incredible.
Yeah. Last season's good. No one, if you don't think so, you just don't understand it.
No, yeah, I love it. Cool. I love it actually. I will say one bossy thing. Go back from the very first scene with the government side of it. I love when they ask who tried to kill him, and no one raises their hand.
Right.
Like to me, it's a perfect like. I like that kind of stuff the most out of this movie, even more so than the Bourne stuff. But yeah, no. What's interesting if when you get a chance to read the script, Bruce, is like Mombosi is a much more prevalent part of the movie, and he's like got more scenes, and in the final act actually involves him. And it's much more different, which I think the movie that we got was infinitely better. But anyway, yeah, so we're into Act Two, right? We're second half.
Well, the second half.
Yeah, we're getting to the midpoint of Act Two, and of course that's Bourne and Marie getting away, checking into the hotel, you know, the cutting of Marie's hair and our romantic interlude, right? Which is initiated by Marie, by the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No. That's true. It is. It is interesting.
Which I will say that I think that was a good decision. I think.
No, that is. I was going to say that my first, like, I think ever experience in movies with the classic, I'm going to cut my hair and dye my hair, was with the Bourne Identity. Mm. And which I know that, you know, again, I was 9 or 10.
What about The Fugitive?
I was 9 or 10. Dye his hair. Yeah. I probably didn't watch The Fugitive until I was a little older, actually. Probably like. Yeah, a little older actually to watch The Fugitive. But anyway, a little small note there. Why do you think it's important to bring up the fact that she initiated it? I think I know what's important, but I want to know what you're thinking is.
Oh, I think it's just cool, and I think it just reflects Marie's character, you know, and of course, and in a kind of ahead of its time sense, you know, Bourne is actually a very thoughtful male character towards the female that he's paired with. You know what I mean? Like, he's always constantly like looking out for her in the best possible way, not making assumptions. Like, you can leave if you want to. You know, it's only when she freaks out near the end of Act Two. You know, I think when the cops have descended on their hotel room or whatever, that she's like trying to run away because she knows he's an assassin, and he's like, no, it's too late, you know, basically saying it's too late, you have to stick with me or you will die. And she, you know, that's the only time where he kind of manhandles her a little bit, but otherwise, I mean, and of course he doesn't really know who he is, and so he seems to be extremely, I don't know, conservative or safe with his actions towards her, you know. But yeah.
Gotcha. So we start Act 3.
Well, no, so we're at the midpoint of Act 2.
Oh, shit. Sorry.
And then this is when they go to her brothers.
It's what we would normally label Act 3. Yes. Yeah. And again, we have this repetition, right? So we start with the goal of figuring out who he is. And this is where we have all the stuff of getting the records from the hotel, going to the yacht company, all that kind of stuff, until, again, we're going to then, you know, launch into action in the second half of it.
There's a great thing in the script where the writer says, you know, if this scene is included in the movie, then it's going, you know, we got to figure out how they get into the embassy, and it's got to be Bourne doing this, or not in the embassy, but into the records, and how right. are we going to do it? And Marie, and it's like this weird paragraph where the writer's actually talking to the director, like, I don't know what the fuck to do. Right. And then in the movie, it's literally like, the way they figured out was like, well, a direct response to the writer's concern was like, she just got it, you know, like that was
you know. It's the equivalent of yes. Indiana Jones shooting yeah. the guy with a scimitar. And again, yeah. it's a lot of fun. They do all this stuff and he's making her memorize all these things. And then she just makes a decision on her own. And
I like it a lot.
No, I like love it.
And it feels realistic. Yeah. It feels like she flirted with a guy and got something, you know, got something she needed out of it. And it's like, I believe yeah, that.
There is something oh, yeah. there about like the male character, like you have to do it this way. And, you know, he's basically, and she's using the tools that Bourne doesn't have, you know what I'm saying? And I think in a really cool way.
Or just thinking like not a super spy, thinking
sure,
like
yeah.
a normal
sure, person. Yeah.
And just, yeah, like a normal, and just to say, we don't really know whether she flirted with him or not. I mean, you know, sure. she kind of walks
implied.
Up. And, she smiles in a nice way, but when she comes out, she says, I just told him I was, you know, your yeah, assistant okay, sure. asked for the records, you know, so, but either way, you're right. I mean, she thinks more like a normal person and just sort of like, okay, what's a plausible way I could ask someone for records, you know? Yeah. And it does work really well. Yeah. And then they go to, the yacht company and he discovers his connection to the yacht that Wambosi owns. And that's when he realizes that he's an assassin, so he's made a big step towards figuring out who he is, but obviously he still doesn't even know like who he works for or anything. He just knows he's an assassin and he was supposed to kill Wambosi, right.
And then yeah, I mean, we kind of start going from there. It, you know, they take refuge at the French countryside
and her brothers and,
at her brother's, yeah. And no, I think it's her friend. It's not her brother, is it? Is it her brother?
I no, it's the guy that she had an affair with.
Oh, it's that guy? Okay. Oh, I didn't realize that. Why did I think it was her brother?
I didn't catch that either. You know, he's got kids there, and we're kind of...
It's heavily really... implied. She never says it directly, but...
Yeah. And they end up, you know, staying there, and it's a great... I think it's a great place visually in contrast to the rest of the movie. And yep. just it adds this, like, I don't know, this small personal kind of, I don't know, I can't explain it, but it's really cool. And of course, whenever this is Clive Owen's big moment, after, you know, he figures out, I can't remember, the dog's missing, yeah, which is a great, again, spy thing. So the dogs are missing, and he tells him to get out, trust him, which is a, you know, a great thing. The guy does, leaves, and I think it's a great diversion.
Just the propane tank.
Yeah, great thing. He just pops out. The way they do it, just the way they film it, everything is a cool moment. He shoots it, explodes, and of course, Clive is can't see very well anymore. And
it's great.
It's a small kind of moment building up towards one of the most one of the best things about the movie is, yes. or it's hinting at something for the rest of the franchise, but also even for Bourne's personal psyche. Whenever he shoots Clive Owen in the field. And Clive says he has this kind of small monologue about, mm-hmm. you know,
it's great.
They did this to us, or, you know, the headaches that Bourne's been mentioning the whole movie. And no, it's a great little moment.
And again, there's sort of less action, you know, from the midpoint to the end of the act, you know, cause you know, with this back and forth, you know, in the first part we had, you know, again, we have this goal of figuring out who he is, and then we're in the apartment, and then we get an action set piece with the fight with the first assassin. But then we get a second action set piece at the end of that with the car chase, right? And so we kind of have two in the first half of Act Two, right? But then we get to the second half of Act Two, and actually, you know, when he has to evade police, it's just that they're going back to their motel room or their hotel room, and all the cops are there and their cover is blown, and there's really no action there. There's just sort of the drama of Marie freaking out and not wanting to be around him because she thinks he might be dangerous. He convinces her to come with her. And she's the one who comes up with going to Aemon's house. They go there. So really, we only have the one action set piece with Clive Owen at the end. And it's a relatively suspenseful one. They don't have a big, you know, fight or anything. It's all about movement and smarts and who's where. And, you know, again, it's really clever. But again, you look at a 60-minute act and we've got three action set pieces, and one of them isn't even all that action. So in a lot of ways, I think, you know, the Bourne reputation as an action movie, I think, is a little misleading. It's not really an action movie. It really is more a straight spy thriller, I think, which obviously will have action in it, I think, than it is, you know, a true action movie. And of course, when we get to the final act, again, we're going to see that there's not a whole lot of, you know, there's a little bit of action, but not nearly as much as you'd think for this kind of movie.
Right. 100%. Yeah, exactly. I think I'd forgotten, even, you know, kind of hinting, I guess, at the third act, how it resolved. I was even kind of, because I've probably seen the Supremacy and Ultimatum more recently than Identity. And so I can still remember how some of those, like the final action set pieces, and those are pretty big, or comparatively. But I was like, wait, I couldn't even remember what like the room looked like or anything.
Yeah.
But it is a pretty, again, I think you're right, Bruce. I think there's a big, really good argument for saying this isn't quite accurate for the genre, because in any other action film, you would have got something much more grandiose at the end, I think, than what we got.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we go into this final act, and by the way, it's only 20 minutes long. It's a really short, fast act, you know, where he, after he kills the professor, you know, he sends Marie off with Aemon, and then, you know, he calls Conklin, and, you know, and again, in classic, almost any kind of movie fashion, the final act is about the confrontation between the protagonist and the antagonist. And so far, Bourne has not met Conklin, really doesn't even know who Conklin is. But if I remember correctly, I guess he's got Clive Owen's phone, I think. And that's how he knows to call Conklin, I guess. And, you know, tells him
he finds out the name Treadstone, right? From Clive.
Okay.
That's where he gets the name Treadstone. Yeah. And I think that's right. Also a part of what starts
right.
figuring out who right. these people are. Right. And that's where I think he finds the address and stuff like that, I think.
Yeah. So he calls Conklin and he sets up this meeting. Right. And then of course he goes and again, in true spycraft fashion, you know, he tells him to meet him on the Pont Neuf Bridge and of course sees that, you know, he's got agents everywhere and doesn't show up, and then follows, right, if I remember correctly, follows Conklin back to the little safe house or headquarters that Nikki is trying to clean up and get, you know, and then we have the final confrontation. So it all happens pretty compressed and pretty quickly, you know, and then this confrontation is purely psychological, you know, in nature, right? I mean, there's no action between him and Conklin. There's just the little action at the end when sort of the other sort of agents come in and he, you know, jumps off the you know, sort of through the staircase with the dead body and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's like the coolest, the moment in the movie. Also, it's like, damn, that would hurt so bad landing on that ground. You know, when he lands for a second, you're like, whoo, you know.
It's also completely unnecessary because there's only one person left with a gun, and this is Jason Bourne. And instead of just taking him out, I mean, I love it, but you know,
I don't need your logic right now.
The solution is to smash this body until the banister falls and ride it down like five flights five floors and shoot the guy on the way down, which is great. But yeah, it's like completely not necessary.
It's definitely a trailer moment for sure. Like that's right. The moment you show at the end of the trailer, like what, right. You know? Yeah. We didn't really talk about Nikki too much. I'm not sure there's a whole lot to say other than
she's barely there in this one.
Yeah. She kind of appears more later, but Yeah, I liked a lot, you know, just when Conklin, when he asked Conklin, you know, are you Treadstone? What is Treadstone? He's like, have you lost like your fucking mind? Or are you?
Yeah, I like the confrontation.
Yeah, I like
how I like Conklin, him trying to kind of like boot camp him.
Yeah,
almost like trying to just get him to respond to like, you know, direct harsh orders again. I'll bring up what I said before. For me, the reveal that he didn't shoot Mombosi because his kids were there, that's hard for me to buy based on his, like, who he's like this super, like, I'm sure he's killed around children before in his career up to this point kind of thing. Right. Like, I can't remember. Did the later movies, is this his first mission?
This is like his 33rd. I think he's like done like 33 confirmed kills or something, or 23 or something. Like
okay. That. So not his first mission, right? I just, that part to me felt a little like it works because it's kind of this emotional moment and it makes him likable. And you're like, oh, like maybe he was always this nice guy even before the amnesia, but it, you know, I don't know what happened. I guess the amnesia fixed, you know, I don't know. To me, it just feels a little bit cliche. I feel like it feels a little bit like, I don't know. It feels a little surface level maybe for the reveal of why he ended up getting shot.
I think I know what you're saying. And I kind of agree with you. I think it and his relationship with Marie and just the way he kind of treats her and everything else, it seems like to me, it implies he was wanting to get out even before that moment. And that was kind of the final trigger. I'm not saying they do a good job of elaborating on that. And they kind of do some things in some of the later movies that kind of show you that it wasn't his choice. So, or it implied that basically it's not his choice. So
is it kind of brainwashed or whatever?
Well, kind of. I mean, we can get into that later, but yeah. Yeah, I think that's what they're trying to say is that it's the impression I got maybe is that he wanted out beforehand.
Yeah, he's been programmed, and later on we have this stuff with the you know, the pills and all that in other movies, but
sure.
You know, you're right, it is a bit cliche, but at the same time, to me it works in the movie. I mean, I don't have any reason to think that necessarily he'd be assassinating people who had kids, you know, in their lap or anything like that. Sure. You know, it's not even to say that he wasn't willing to kill Mombosi because he had kids. It's that when he finally got his moment, Wambosi's kids were literally asleep in his lap. But also, you know, we have this, the whole movie depends on these characters sort of fighting against or rebelling against the programming of Treadstone, you know, and for Bourne, this is the moment where he kind of breaks, you know, where he's sort of like, I don't know if I want to do this, or at least I'm not going to do it in this particular moment. And then he gets shot and dumped overboard and gets amnesia. And that's what allows him to have to sort of question everything. So, you know, I buy it. It's just a trigger, right? It's a triggering moment to allow everything else to happen.
Yeah.
And then also through the actions, I mean, you could think all day long, Jason Bourne before the shooting knows who he's working for, what they're capable of, but then now that he doesn't know who he's working for and he gets to experience the nature of the government trying to kill you when you know I'm saying, that definitely adds to like, oh, I'm more expendable than I maybe thought I was, so, or at least that you can look at yourself that way too. So I see it. It didn't bother me too much. I think honestly the thing that went through my head was like, oh, Bourne, you should be smarter. Like, you knew, like, why didn't you know the kids were with him? Like, that's what I thought, honestly, when I saw it, but which is like the reaction you had.
It just felt a little sloppy compared to everything else we've seen from Bourne, I guess. Or a little bit just like, but he's like been programmed. What happened to the programming, I guess. But I agree with you. It works enough. It doesn't bother me enough that I like feel frustrated. It's just kind of like, okay. And I do think that brings up, you know, another thing that I enjoy is obviously when Conklin is dealt with for his failure, which becomes a running trend in the series, is like everyone that tries to stop him and fails gets killed by the US government. And I think it's interesting that this movie is kind of anti-US in that way, anti-CIA or whatever you want. I mean, the US Army did not sponsor this film like they did the Marvel movies, is what I'm trying to say. And you know, I'm just saying, it is – it makes you, the US is the bad guys like throughout this almost entire series. And I like that too. I feel like that almost, I'm not well versed in enough in like the espionage or the other kinds of films that came before this, but this kind of feels like a more realistic version of the USA than we get in maybe a lot of other spy or things like that. It just feels like this feels real world. This feels like if this actually happened, if the USA really had a Treadstone, and it probably has in different versions through the CIA, through the 70s and 80s and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so 100%. It feels like, and if this got sloppy, this is exactly how they'd handle it. They would clean it up, make sure there's nothing that draws it back to them. And whoever fails gets killed by the superior officer.
I don't think there's anything in that. I you know, that surprises me or anything. And
No.
I mean, it feels different.
It feels like a change in, like, I don't know, maybe this was happening prior to these movies. But I mean, the 80s and the 90s were a lot of pro-American action films, right? I mean, like, we still had a lot of, like,
I think there are other movies.
I mean, like, when you start getting into, like, post-JFK, like, assassination, you start getting to like Vietnam, and those movies really start delving into the consequences of government. And I think it's something.
I think the 80s in particular, Daniel's right. You know, if you go back to the 70s and like you said, JFK, Vietnam, Watergate, then you got movies like The Parallax View, and you've got the government working nefariously against its own citizens. You know, yes. I think in the 80s, we don't see that nearly as often, but probably I'm not necessarily thinking of examples from the 90s, but just going back to Spy Games, you know, that whole movie is about the U.S. government burning Brad Pitt's character and Robert Redford trying to protect him get him out, you know.
Is Spy Games the one where he goes, he's in a plane, and he crashes, and then Robert Redford's trying to get him back over?
That one is with Owen Wilson.
That's Behind Enemy Lines.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
That's a World War II movie, right?
Damn.
If you have not watched Spy Games, you absolutely must. It's one of the best spy movies, in my opinion. Brad Pitt ends up in a Chinese prison because he's trying to break out this woman he's in love with, that he's fallen in love with as a spy. And so the movie sort of has this present day story where Robert Redford is trying to figure out what's going on and work against the CIA from basically burning him and he's doing all this stuff. And then it flashes back and tells the story of their relationship and then how Brad Pitt ended up falling in love and all this. It's a great spy movie.
You know what, Bruce? I have not seen Spy Games. I have.
You have to watch it tonight.
on my queue right now, on my Apple TV, I have Condor and I have Sneakers. Two Robert Redford movies. So I'll add that to the list.
Sneakers is also a great movie. I love Sneakers too. It's much more of a fun, whimsical kind of spy movie. But Spy Games is excellent. In terms of a movie about spy craft that still has some action, it's just a lot of fun. It's really good. You got to watch Spy Games.
Absolutely. I need to watch it. I was thinking of Behind
the Enemy Lines. It's Tony Scott, you know? I mean, it's just
filled with
all kinds of awesome visuals and
I need to watch it. I'm not perfect. I miss movies every now. Right. That's what I have you for.
Yeah.
Well, let's wrap up the board.
Yeah, wrap it up. Exactly.
Kind of final thoughts on the film. I'll kick it off since I transitioned us.
good transition.
Yeah, thank you. Again, I think it's this film. I personally really like Supremacy. Identity, Supremacy, Ultimatum in my order. And to me, Supremacy still feels like the stakes are low in this kind of more interesting way, at least with the revenge part of that film. But I think, to me, the Bourne movies will always kind of hold this a unique place for me. And I think maybe, you know, what we discussed today has really even shown me more of that, is that it's not really a true action film. And I've never been one to say like, oh, action movies all day long. You know, like I'm more like, give me action, but I need a healthy dosing of heart and of character and of narrative that is, you know, interesting to keep me involved. I can't just go action scene to action scene. That's not my kind of movie, for the most part. You know, John Wick, I give some exception to. Yeah, I still think the Bourne movies, they still feel unique, I guess, in that way. I know we've not discussed it here, but, you know, what an oft comparison is Casino Royale and how it took a lot of Bourne's qualities and integrated them in more into the Bond universe to make Bond feel more grounded. Even the fight scenes feel a bit more like Bourne than they did in previous films and stuff like that. So yeah, I think I'll always be a Bourne fan. I mean, I do feel like the last two were a little more cash grabby for me, and didn't appreciate that. But I'm always down if they can find more interesting ways to do Bourne. I'm always down for more.
One thing I want to say about the end of the movie, I love how it ends when he comes up in the shack.
Yes,
and it's very one-linery. Do you have an ID? You know, and it's just like the perfect on your nose thing to say. And I personally love it. And it's a good feel good moment. And it ends with every movie ends with the same song. And
it's
I'm
the best
all
song
for
ever.
It. I'm
it's
all
the best
for
song
it.
Ever. It's like my favorite ending song. It's just it's iconic now.
Yeah, no, it's great. And he remixes it almost every movie, like a different version of it. But no,
he being Paul Oakenfold, by the way.
Just yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I enjoy them and stuff, but there's just something about, I mean, I've seen probably the first three at least five or six times a piece. And I've seen the last two twice a piece now. I enjoy them, you know, fun and I can't talk today. I actually like the Bourne Legacy quite a bit. And I think it's because it kind of starts expanding it and making it more about, it feels more global and like bigger, almost like the James Bond kind of thing. It starts kind of feeling more like we can go on different stories versus Bourne's, which is who I am. Jason Bourne is very much like they're really like every grain they can of who Bourne is or why he joined the program. It's like, Jesus Christ. Like I feel like we got over that, you know, definitely in the first movie, but movie two and three and stuff. I like two a lot because he's driven and he's, you know, he's kind of making them react more. And on top of that, we're figuring out why the agency is trying to frame him. So it's kind of like what they're doing in that way. So I like two a lot, actually. I think it's cool. And three's got some good stuff in it too, but I enjoy the first movie. I'm not sure if I have a favorite or anything, but I mean, it's fun. You keep asking this question, Daniel, has it changed movies? I think there's other movies that predate it that are similar in style. I can't name a few at the like, top of my head in terms of like their action sequences. And I know later in like two and three, especially three, we have like this really quick cutty. We're not seeing the pullback or the wind up and the connect. We're just seeing the finished product of every move. And I know it's a big thing we talk about in school and stuff with sound design and everything. I think we're, you know, it, obviously movies try to replicate that because it's in a lot of ways and they typically fail because you know the action is either just not as thought out or it's just they don't have a strong enough story to support that. A good example is like Taken 3 when you have him jump over a fence and it's like literally 37 cuts and eight or like 3 seconds or something crazy like that. But I feel like we're getting now to a place where action movies are being appreciated more because of the intricacy, the ballet aspect of it versus the simplicity of it. And so whenever movies do attempt that Bourne aesthetic for editing, they don't get remembered as well because, you know, people want to see John Wick now. They want to see the really intricate, impossible martial arts ballet stuff. Anyway, a lot of vomit there.
No, I would agree with that. I don't really think the Bourne movies kind of were revolutionary in their shooting and editing style. And on, first of all, we just need to note that the first Bourne movie really isn't that at all, you know, directed by Doug Liman. I mean, other than the fight in the Paris apartment, is kind of the only one that gets a little bit of like, shoot it from a bunch of different angles and get a little choppy with it. You know, Paul Greengrass really brings that to an extreme in the next two movies. And that's certainly a style that is associated with him, that he did on the, oh, I forget the 9/11 movie about the plane that was hijacked. You know, he did it on that
flight
movie too.
Something.
Yeah, I can't remember the flight number though. I should. It's American history, but anyway, you know, so I think that's associated with him, and I think that those movies actually got pointed to as almost the culmination of that style rather than the start of that style. Because honestly, you can go back to like Michael Bay movies, and the movie that always comes to my mind is The Rock, which is very much shot in that style. There's a car chase in The Rock that has, I don't think a shot lasts more than 1 second, and you literally have no idea where any of the cars are. It's just a bunch of flashes of cars. And that movie came out in 1996. So that's whatever, yeah, 7 years before The Bourne Identity, almost 10 years before, you know, Supremacy and Ultimatum. So, you know, so I don't think the style was new. I think maybe, if anything, the style just, you know, had sort of reached a point where people were starting to get a little tired of it. Not to say that it didn't extend, you know, a while afterwards, but I agree with Donovan. I think we've actually seen kind of a move away from that. I think now we almost associate that with sort of B-level directors, you know, making action movies, and that the movies like John Wick, you know, are much more choreographed. And that's part of why those movies are now so popular, is because, you know, even regardless of what you guys thought about Atomic Blonde, you know, the same kind of people, the same kind of style there, mm-hmm, right? So for me, you know, Bourne was just always, again, kind of that, like, that melding of action and spy thriller that just felt a little unique. It inhabited a space where, you know, it wasn't the John Le Carré, you know, sort of very thoughtful, almost no action kind of spy movie, but it wasn't the Bond movie where, you know, huge budget, almost all action. It had a kind of one foot in each world. And I think that's why I've always enjoyed them. Not that they're amazing movies necessarily, they're good movies that maybe occupy a unique niche, you know, that maybe no other movies during that time were really filling.
Yeah.
I will say there's one thing that I think the Bourne movies at least popularized that has carried on really well, and you kind of mentioned it with Casino Royale, is the idea of the, you're taking the action, or at least the things like the pen, like you're bringing it down to a realistic, or trying to bring it down to a realistic level. And then I think that that tone or that idea, that is what carried over to the, to, you know, Casino Royale, where you have like a real life Bond versus Pierce Brosnan doing, you know, whatever, which I love Pierce Brosnan's Bond. So I think that's what carried over. And then funny enough, those movies end up going more back into classic Bond as they got older. But things like that, like I still see that idea even in John Wick later, of like, even though John Wick is a lot of gung-fu, there is still this idea of we're going to use the environment and realistic kind of stuff like that. That to me is the thing that has carried over, at least that it popularized. That's what carried over to me that I could still see in the movies today, is that idea.
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because that also goes back to the influence of video games on movies, and specifically like in Bond movies where, or, you know, where in, or Bond video games, the old, what was the old sort of,
we had GoldenEye, for instance.
Yeah, GoldenEye. You know, and you would like, you know, you would shoot things that would explode, and you would, you know, and then of course a lot of other video games, you know, you'd use the environment in that, not necessarily at the level of detail of a pen, but that you could use the environment that way. And then you started seeing it in the movies, right? So in Bourne Identity and Casino Royale, in both of them, we have characters blowing up a propane tank in order to either distract their opponent or get away or whatever, you know? So it is kind of interesting the way those, you know, video games influence movies, influence video games, influence movies. Yeah. And you know, you have all that happening with those style movies.
Yeah. If you're ever being chased by zombies, you got to look for the red propane tank on your field, you know, in the game. Right. It's like, oh, there it is. Boom. You know, and then you're done.
Right.
But yeah.
No, I do think I agree that feels, it just makes it adds a layer of realism. We think of it, well, if I was in those shoes, I would do anything possible to survive. You know what I mean? Like it just feels like I think the characters just feel more realistic versus when a movie prescribes this perfect sequence of, oh, well, he has a gadget here, or he just takes them down with his bare hands because he can, because, you know what I mean?
And it gets back to that question of spycraft, you know, and I think that's part of what's fun about it is you have a character who seems really aware of his environment, you know, and yeah. I think that was one of the cool things with Bourne is, you know, again, all the things we've talked about, the sign in the embassy, the pen, the field, and not just the field, you know, he sort of uses the propane tank and then uses the field against Clive Owen, who's hiding in the field. But then once he loses track of Bourne, then Bourne can use the wheat field to his advantage, you know? And so, yeah, it allows the characters to feel more interesting and smarter in the way they do things by their use of the environment.
I will say, and this even connected even further, on the franchise of a whole, in Bourne Ultimatum, when he uses the book and the way he like basically mm-hmm. three taps him with the book in different ways, I think that's like my favorite thing action-wise in the entire franchise, just that little 2-second moment. And then I was like, no one will ever be able to top that with a book. And then John Wick 3 come out and he does a very similar thing in a library with a book. And so clearly there's influence to me that has carried over. Yeah.
By the way, that same fight sequence, when the guy he's fighting pulls out the razor blade,
and the towel, and the towel,
he has that, the towel that part. He uses for defense. Yes. Yeah. And again, I think that kind of thing, perhaps has had a little bit of influence and I think we see that more, in movies now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there's even some, like, I mean, I think of like the elevator scene in Captain America, the Winter Soldier. And I feel like these just kind of using anything I know in that movie it's almost very similar. He's like doing, you know, pulling different people's like gadgets and doing stuff like that when he's taking them down or connecting them together or whatever he's doing. And I feel like, you know, even in Marvel movies, which we expect much more grandiose battles, we when we think of Marvel movies, we think of the battle between Cap and Iron Man and Thor in Endgame and them fighting Thanos and Cap picking up the hammer and all this. But I think even with Cap, and I think Winter Soldier is a great one because, you know, we've said many times that like that movie's just a great espionage kind of spy thriller with all the Hydra stuff and you know, mm-hmm. anyway, I feel like there's some parallels and some things even in those movies that we see that are similar.
Yeah, I mean it's a spy thriller with the blockbuster paint thrown all over it. It's much exactly. more
sure, of course.
It's much more like the tropes of spy stuff in that movie versus like true, like, you know, obviously yes. Bourne's way more. And one of their big influences, the Russo brothers, is Condor, which I brought up earlier. That's one of their big influences in that movie. I will watch Bourne, I'm sure, many more times in the future. And I'm glad we talked about it, especially about the action stuff. This question, Bruce, side note, what's your favorite action movie, or do you have a favorite action franchise? That's something you really got besides Atomic Blonde.
I don't know. I mean, I'm probably drawn more to like Bond movies than the Marvel movies. I mean,
I watch
the Marvel movies all day long, but I think, you know, especially like the Daniel Craig Bond movies have always held a special place for me. I go back to those a lot.
I don't even think of Marvel when I think of action. Isn't that weird? I really don't. That's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just sort of a more bigger type of universe. So I don't know. I'd have to, and you know, I like the John Wick movies as well. I'd have to think about that a little bit more. But yeah, you know, I think the first thing that comes to mind is the Bond movies. I also really enjoy, you know, the Mission Impossible franchise. That. Just when it looked like it was about to run out of steam. And speaking of Jeremy Renner in Marvel movies, but also was supposed to be the new Bourne, and that didn't work out. He was supposed to take over Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
But then that Mission Impossible did so well. It sort of breathed new life back into the franchise and, you know, starting like, I don't remember, 4 through 7, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed those a lot, and you know, I can't wait for the you know, the Mission Impossible movie where Tom Cruise finally dies. I mean, it's going to be amazing.
I suspect he will.
You know, he will literally die on set doing something.
That's
crazy
very possible.
Oh, yes.
You know, yeah. I don't mean the character. I literally mean Tom Cruise dying.
He probably has some kind of clause.
To do a stunt he can't do. Yeah.
He probably has some kind of clause that's like, if I die doing the stunt, you have to finish the movie and write it into the movie. Like I would, if I was doing those, I'd be like, listen, if I die, this has got to be worth it. I better get a posthumous, you know, Oscar for this. So just finish the film, write it in.
You know, it's funny. You know, I think my favorite Mission Impossible is Mission Impossible 1, which is, it's the most spy heavy one of all of them, right. in my opinion.
Spy thriller. Yeah.
Yeah. I really like it a lot.
I like JJ's. I'm the guy that likes JJ's Mission Impossible.
Yeah. I mean, 3 has also, you know, a lot more mystery to it than the other ones does.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah. True. Yeah. Why does the rabbit leg or tail or whatever it is? Speaking of Marvel real quick, I want to go ahead and put it on the record here. I think our next two movies should be Infinity War and Endgame, because we're coming up on the 2-year and the 3-year. Well, it may be 2 episodes or whatever, but 2-year and 3-year anniversaries of both movies.
Okay.
And I would like to do that.
It's going to take a little more work. Those are big movies.
I think I'm not saying they're complicated, but I think they're interesting to talk about. Structurally. So
I have broken down the first Avengers movie, but I haven't done the rest of them. So that'll be an interesting challenge. I'm sure their sequence structure would be my guess. So.
Yeah, Infinity War has to be sequence structure. Yeah, it has to.
I think Endgame and Infinity War probably have a very different structure in some, or at least they. I think they do. I think they have a pretty variedly different plot structure, or at least pacing, or how they use that plot structure. So,
But no, I'm glad we did this one, guys. Is there any final thoughts real quick? I'm pretty sure we covered it all. Yeah. Daniel, how can our listeners write into us?
You can write into bit.ly/2for1mail. Let us know, do you like the Bourne movies? Which one's your favorite one? What's your favorite action scene? And that's about it. That's all I wanted to really know. Nothing else.
If you can't hit our bit.ly up, of course, leave us a comment below if you're on YouTube. And if you're not, go to youtube.com/2for1studios. It's the best place to consume the content. I think we almost have over 100 pieces of content. This is episode 71. So there's all that content you're not getting on your podcast services that you're not even seeing.
We've got a great new trailer on the YouTube homepage that kind of shows you a little bit.
I saw that. I thought it was great. I love all the different kind of ways that you guys are branching out. I think it's awesome.
Thanks.
Yeah. We've got more in the future. We're working on, we're wanting to produce some narrative stuff as well. Some short film, may dip our feet even into some fan film type stuff. Just having fun. You know, nice.
That's what I would love to do.
I'll be back before then, but make sure you get me on the 100th episode. I'm requesting now to be on the 100th podcast episode.
I was planning on it. So we're getting close.
We might need, you know, we need to do at some point is have like, I would love to have like several guests on for some kind of special.
Well, I'd planned on, at some point. I would love really to fun. Like snap people in, you know, that's what I was thinking about.
That would be cool. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Like we snap Matt in, we're like, oh fuck, we snap Matt back out real quick, and that's Matt's cameo. Yeah. You know,
That's exactly what I'm thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, guys, thank you again, Bruce, so much. My name is Donovan Thompson.
I'm Daniel Wingfield.
And I'm Dr. Bruce Hutchinson.
And we have spoken.